need a large shelter. There's just no question about it. Everyone admits that. And I proposed a plan and I was shot down for 2 years.
Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson discusses his first 2 years leading Alaska's largest city. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 2nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Rising temperatures drive increased fire activity in the interior.
High 80s to low 90s by Saturday and Sunday. That's just going to continue to dry out the vegetation and make it more receptive to fire.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health. But did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Warming and drying increased wildfire activity around the interior yesterday, including on the Anderson complex of five fires west of the Nenana River and Parks Highway near the city of Anderson. Fire Information Officer Jeff Lysik says the Denali Borough put two additional areas into go evacuation status Tuesday in response to an increase in activity on the Birch Creek fire.
All residents in Clear Sky Homestead, but not the Clear Sky Lodge, and the residents of Rose Hip Creek were placed in evacuation status go Tuesday morning by the borough.
The Teklanika River area remains in go status due to the Teklanika River fire, the largest in the complex. Lysik says it made a small push toward the Nenana River late Tuesday.
We had a plane do some retardant drops around that time, and then we had a helicopter start making water drops to help reduce the fire activity in that area.
Lysik says nearly 200 people, including three hotshot crews, one from Alaska and two from California, are among those working Anderson Complex wildfires.
The Midnight Suns and the Lassen hotshots are up on the Teklanika River fire. And then the Shasta Lake hotshots are actually camping out now in the area of the Clear Sky Homestead. And they'll be working in there to identify structures and make a plan for how best to protect those from the Birch Creek fire should it move in that direction.
The Anderson area was also threatened by wildfire last summer, and Lysik says firefighters are working to reestablish protections near the city. All the work is in anticipation of worsening conditions. Lysik points to forecasted hot temperatures.
The high 80s to low 90s by Saturday and Sunday, that's just going to continue to dry out the vegetation and make it more receptive to fire. So we are ordering additional firefighting personnel and equipment into the area.
Anderson Complex fire managers have scheduled a community meeting tonight at 8 at the Anderson Fire Station. The meeting will also be accessible on Facebook. Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson has just entered his third year leading the state's largest city. His tenure has been marked by a growing homelessness crisis, a contentious relationship with the Assembly, and frustration over a slow response to a historic series of snowstorms. Bronson spoke with Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early about his tenure. This interview has been edited for length, but you can listen to or read the entire interview on our website at alaskapublic.org. Bronson says his biggest achievement has been renewed focus in repairing the Port of Alaska.
That port feeds 90% of this state, all of Anchorage, and it's in dire need of repair. We're in the middle of a long modernization program. I took that project and the engineering and the designing and the building of it and kind of reassigned it to a different group, to an engineering firm, actually, that's built ports before. That would be Jacobs, and they've got a lot of experience, and that got us back on track, I think. So it's not flashy, it's not cool, but I'll be honest with you, it's the single most important project in the state by far.
So I'd like to start with homelessness. All of the city's shelter beds are currently full. Meanwhile, we're seeing homelessness encampments growing around town, the big ones over at 3rd and Ingra. And there's been a record number of outdoor deaths with 29.
Mm-hmm. 31.
Is it 31 now?
Yeah, I just talked to the police chief yesterday. It's 31.
Well, 2 years into your administration, what's the current plan to address the city's homelessness crisis, and where do you think the money for that plan would come from?
The city has spent $161 million on homelessness in the last 3 years, ending the end of 22. We've done some really good things. We've partnered with some great partners, Providence, Salvation Army, a lot of really good partners there. But at the end of the day, you can't have a homeless response system without having a shelter, and we don't have a shelter of any consequence. And we have 700, and as of 2 weeks ago, the count was 775 unsheltered people. And to get to the point, and this is a point of legality, and I think you need to understand that, understand this is that until I create 776 shelter beds, I'm not allowed to abate these camps that are on public property. I'll challenge you a little bit on the notion that all these camps are growing. No, they're shifting. We're still sitting at an aggregate about 775. That's rough. But they're shifting, and we're kind of playing a whack-a-mole, but we're compelled to do that by law, and it's based on a court decision, Martin versus Boise from 2017. So, and we're in Ninth Circuit, so we have to abide by that. And we need some relief from that. We need a large shelter. There's just no question about it. Everyone admits that. I proposed a plan. Now to your first question, I proposed a plan and I was shot down for 2 years. At the end of the day, I will provide here within a couple of weeks, our housing homeless coordinator, Alexis Johnson, will create a cold weather shelter plan. That shelter plan, we are not required by law to provide space. We're required to provide a plan. I suspect that plan will include things like churches, nonprofits will have to open their space to these people.
So with the Sullivan off the table and returning as an entertainment venue, how likely do you think that there will be a shelter in place by winter?
That's a good question for the assembly. They're working on this. They're studying it. I think we need to be building and not studying. We did a great big study just before I came into office. A group paid for a study, and we looked at 71 different sites. We came up to a building on a site. That site is Elmore and Tudor. That building was designed for that site. The assembly, a couple of members, and they had input on the design of what went into the building, the inside of it. And then it was stopped, and it wasn't restarted, the construction. In the middle of a concrete pour, it was for the foundation, it was stopped. And that's a question not for me. That's a question for assembly. The assembly, what are their plans for a shelter in the winter? I've done everything I can for 2 years. I'm out of ideas.
So it's fair to say at this point, you're hoping that whatever shelter is stood up, you can match it with whatever the current houses population is.
I got to get to 776. That's I got to deal in numbers. Because that's what this portion of this discussion is all about, is what are the numbers? And I think the 29,000, 30,000 square foot facility in Tudor Elmont could handle that.
So your administration faced a lot of backlash last winter over the response to the historic snowfall. From your perspective, what went wrong there? And do you believe your administration is more prepared this year?
Well, I think your question answers itself, historic snowfall. It's a volume issue. It's a numbers issue. And could we have done things better? We immediately after that, I directed a review process. We call it a roundtable. We have on the calendar the third meeting of that roundtable where we come to final solutions. We need to get back to 2008, 2009, when we had a lot of flexibility in our response to snowfalls. For example, this was a big thing for me during that series of snowfalls. It was very problematic. We would have been far better to get that 6 feet of snow all at once instead of 2 feet, 2 days off, 2 feet. That was the problem.
I understand that last year was a historic snowfall, but do you plan or do you think that you've got a plan in place that will prevent people from sort of being down to one lane on their streets, you know, and sort of a lot of the snowplow problems that we had last year?
We added a lot of money to the snow plowing budget, but guess what's going to happen? Same thing happened to Dan Sullivan, by the way, Mayor Sullivan. he had a big snowfall. It was inadequate. They came back at it a lot of money. And then we had several years of extremely low snowfall. And the property taxpayers are saying, why are we paying extra property taxes for snow removal? We haven't had snow in 2 months and it's February, that kind of thing. But that's called the business of politics, running a city. I'm supposed to take that kind of abuse, good or bad. It just doesn't matter.
That was Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson talking to Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early. Again, you can listen to the full interview on our website, alaskapublic.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Bristol Bay fishermen call for more transparency on sockeye prices.
I know guys that are not able to pay their crews this year. They're going to have to borrow money to pay their crews. And I know people that, you know, they're trying to figure out how they're going to fly home right now.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What gives you strength? Strength comes from teaching the Alaskan way of life, getting wood, fishing, hunting, helping people in the community, and being an example for the next generation. If you have forgotten your strength, remember, there's hope, there's joy, there's love, there's peace everywhere. Share what gives you strength at recoveralaska.org/share-your-strength. This message sponsored by Recover Alaska.
An Alaska woman is suing the federal government over sexual abuse she says she suffered at the hands of the warden and staff at a California prison that came to be known as a, quote, rape club. According to the lawsuit filed Monday, the woman was an inmate at a low-security prison in Dublin, California, when the warden, Ray Garcia, started grooming her in 2019. The lawsuit says that evolved into sexual contact and harassment that continued when the woman returned to Alaska to finish her sentence at a halfway house. Under federal law, there is no circumstance under which an incarcerated person can legally consent to sex with a prison official. The woman, named only by her initials in the lawsuit, testified at Garcia's criminal trial in 2022, as did other victims, which led a jury to convict Garcia and a judge to sentence him to nearly 6 years behind bars. The woman's lawsuit seeks an unspecified sum of money to be determined in court. Congresswoman Mary Peltola is ramping up fundraising for her 2024 re-election campaign. Nationally, the Alaska seat is among the top targets for a Republican takeover. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports on the state of fundraising for an election that's still more than a year away.
Peltola's latest campaign finance report shows she raised nearly $600,000 over 3 months. It was a substantial boost from the report covering the first quarter of the year, in which the campaign spent more than it raised. Her campaign manager, Anton McParland, says they started the year with a bit of a breather.
Feeling like Alaskans deserved some time away from campaigning generally. But we're in full throttle for quarter two.
A candidate's quarterly campaign finance reports provide insight into the race, and Peltola's already suggests that this campaign will draw a lot of money and attention from outside the state.
This will be one of the most competitive races in the country.
Ben Peterson is a spokesman for the National Republican Congressional Committee working to keep the House in Republican hands. He says Peltola is vulnerable because she's a Democrat from a state that voted heavily for Donald Trump in the last election, and both parties are gearing up to fight for the seat. So far, one Republican is in the race, Chugiak businessman Nick Begich, who came in third in last year's U.S. House race. Begich says it's telling that Peltola raised a lot of money this year from political action committees.
Nearly $300,000 only 6 months in from political action committees and special interests. I think that speaks volumes about where she's at in D.C.
Peltola's PAC money comes from a variety of groups, from unions to airlines and defense contractors. ExxonMobil's PAC gave her $1,000. So did a PAC affiliated with the Environmental Defense Fund. A PAC dedicated to helping mothers, called Moms Fed Up, gave her twice that. Begich points out that a lot of the PAC money comes from liberal groups, including committees associated with Democratic leaders like Hakeem Jeffries and Nancy Pelosi.
I really think that kind of demonstrates, you know, some of the more left-leaning support that she's got, because she's quite frankly sided with many of the most left representatives in the House.
It's true that Peltola votes in line with the Democratic position most of the time, but she's voted against her party 47 times this year, according to a vote database maintained by ProPublica. That means Peltola is one of the Democrats who most frequently crosses the aisle to vote. McParland, Peltola's campaign manager, says the wide range of PACs shows donors are tired of extreme partisanship and appreciate her moderate approach. Most of Peltola's total came from individual donors, while Alaskans gave more than residents of any other single state. In-state contributions amount to only about a quarter of the total. McParland says that's likely to continue, a reflection, he says, of Alaska's relatively small population compared to the rest of the country. Begich's quarterly report shows no fundraising yet this year. Last year, he loaned his campaign $650,000 and after the election withdrew about a third of that from his campaign account to repay himself. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
In late July, roughly 100 fishing vessels joined together on the Naknek River to protest this year's sockeye price of 50 cents per pound. When adjusted for inflation, it's the lowest in several decades. As KDLG's Christina McDermott reports, many Bristol Bay crews say they feel frustrated by the lack of transparency between processors and fleets.
There's a multi-decade precedent for Bristol Bay salmon processors to wait until the season is underway to announce what they're willing to pay. But Captain Conrad Schad of the fishing vessel Skua says this model hurts fishers.
The producer gets paid what's left over. We produce the fish, and then it gets processed and sold and everything, and everybody gets their cut. And then if the morsels that are left over, they give to us, there should be a fixed cost for what we produce here and then add it on.
In Bristol Bay, commercial fishing crews fish on what's called an open ticket. That means starting before they know how much their catch will sell for, and they pay to prepare. Captains spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on permits and invest in costly improvements to best tackle the breakneck run. Then there's storage and haulout fees, sometimes thousands of dollars worth. Trident Seafoods was the first processor to announce a 50 cents per pound base price this year. In a letter to its fleet, Trident blamed a saturated market, Russian undercuts, and inflation for the low price. North Pacific Seafoods and Peter Pan Seafoods announced the same price a few days later. David Couch, who captains the fishing vessel Icarus, says processors told fleets the price would be low before the season started, but they did not specify how low.
You know, I know guys that are not able to pay their crews this year. They're going to have to borrow money to pay their crews. And I know people that, you know, they're trying to figure out how they're going to fly home right now, what credit card they're going to put the airfares on.
He says the relationship between processors and fleets needs restructuring.
You know, if they made a commitment for a large price on a large year, they could be out of business too. So there has to be some type of transparency and, you know, way that we can talk.
Couch suggests coming up with an agreement wherein fishing crews receive a percentage of the profit rather than wait for a base price. Captain Fran Call of the fishing vessel Janet Elaine says processors could post a price early and pay over time.
There are creative solutions and everyone's going to have to dig deep to find them, but one that we've been throwing around is, you know, post a price, it's risky. Don't have to pay the fishermen 100% right away, but, you know, pay them as that pack is sold, so that they're not holding high interest rates.
The Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association is an organization that fleets pay into to market their fish. It's circulating a petition calling for greater transparency for this year. It cites a 1970 statute that empowers the Department of Labor to mediate price disputes between fishing crews and processors. In order for the state to get involved, the statute says that one-third of registered commercial fishers need to disagree with the offered price. The Development Association Executive Director, Andy Wink, says the petition gives fishing crews the opportunity to dispute this year's 50 cents.
If they are looking for more answers and transparency in terms of explaining this year's price and just kind of going through a mediation process to see where that might go, we wanted to make sure that we made that option available.
He says the state's involvement could lead to a productive conversation between processors and fishermen going forward and could help ensure parties adhere to antitrust laws. Bristol Bay's major processors have refused request for comment on this year's low price and have not responded to request for comment on industry transparency. In Dillingham, I'm Christina McDermott.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Quality childcare creates futures for families, children, and the state's economy. When children are safe, engaged, and learning, parents can work and everyone has a better outcome. THREAD has resources to support your family in their childcare search. Knowing what to look for in a licensed facility is important for the safety of your children. THREAD also offers parenting resources and support. To learn more about quality childcare in Alaska, visit threadalaska.org. This message sponsored by THREAD.
Sustaining membership offers public media greater financial stability month to month. So consider making a sustaining gift to this station. Thank you.
The Anchorage Economic Development Corporation is predicting the city will see a slight increase in population this year for the first time since 2016.
In 2023, AEDC projects that Anchorage will finally, after a long period of decline, turn the corner on population loss and will see a whopping 0.3% increase in overall population.
In his final address as president and CEO of AEDC today, Bill Popp laid out a three-year outlook for Anchorage covering a variety of economic sectors. Popp says the main drivers behind the predicted population increase are a recent spike in births and a decline in deaths. But Popp says the city is still facing a shrinking workforce. He says due to a surging demand for jobs and a decline in working-age adults, there have been about twice as many jobs posted this year as there are available workers in the Anchorage and Matsu area. Popp pointed to a shortage of housing as the main obstacle to attracting more workers, saying that there were only 180 single-family homes built last year, the fewest in a decade.
If we are to attract and retain the workers in all skill categories that Anchorage needs to maintain and grow the economy, our city must innovate rapidly and rapidly implement new housing policies and initiatives to overcome our housing shortage.
Aside from population factors, Popp highlighted historically high personal income growth, decreasing inflation, and continued growth in tourism as positive trends. He also predicted a potential long-term uptick in oil production from the Pikka and Willow projects. Popp will be stepping down as AEDC president and CEO this year. He is also a member of Alaska Public Media's board of directors. Well, two swimmers successfully crossed the Frederick Sound near Petersburg in mid-July. They spent hours in the glacial-fed sound, which runs 600 feet deep in parts. As KFSK's Shelby Herbert reports from one of the rescue boats, it's the first time in living memory that anyone ever made it across the seven-mile stretch.
There are icebergs on the horizon, and the surface temperature hovers in the low 50s. The waters of the Frederick Sound are cold, like knives in your skin cold. That's how it feels when I go to grab a diver down flag that fell overboard.
Here goes nothing. Didn't make it very far.
Yeah, no. When you're completely immersed, it feels like the breath is being sucked out of your lungs. That's why Andrew Simmons is wearing a wetsuit so thick, it takes him half an hour to put it on. The suit protects him from the worst of the chill, but he'll spend the rest of the day in that freezing water.
Okay, here we are.
All right.
Simmons, age 61, is the first person in living memory to try to swim across the Sound. Last summer, he got close, but didn't quite make it. He wants to make it all the way this time, in what he says will be his last try. But things have changed. Now, he's going for silver, Simmons was beaten to the punch. Another swimmer made it across just 3 days earlier. His name, Scott May.
It was actually the shortest tide swing of the month, and the weather was looking beautiful.
May, age 59, is a retired teacher from Juneau. He saw the right opportunity this week and pounced.
So I talked to my wife, Bridget, and my good friend, Tommy Thompson, and said, hey, let's go out on the boat Wednesday morning. We went over there and jumped in the water, and the rest is history, I guess.
Scott may have been the first to cross, but he took the shortest route. Simmons is gunning for the longest way across, 7 miles. But there's camaraderie between the two swimmers, even from a distance. They didn't meet in person until after Simmons' second attempt. But today, May is watching his swim from his house through a pair of binoculars. Last year, Simmons had to fight a strong current before he reached the end. It burned him out, and he had to get back on the boat. He admitted he's worried his old bones won't make it, but he's laughing through the nerves, like all those surrounding his deep fear of bumping into the marine life lurking below.
I thought I would have a heart attack if, as I looked down into the water, if there were eyeballs looking up at me. It would have really freaked me out. But that was part of it, facing one's fears.
Simmons is 3/4 of the way across the sound when the discomfort really sets in. Joseph Kitzland is piloting the rescue boat. He periodically stops to check in with the man in the water, sometimes offering him food, chocolate chip cookies and milk, per his request.
Want a cookie?
Yeah, I think one more.
Good.
How's the current going?
Good.
He's flagging a bit, and he's fighting the current, just like last year. From the captain's seat, Kitzland points out how it's strong enough to move his boat.
We're drifting a little bit this way with the current.
But his arms and legs never stop churning. 7 hours after he left the shore of Sandy Beach, Andrew Simmons touches the face of the cliff on the other side.
Don't stop!
Stay in the moment. You smell it?
Last year, Simmons said he was crossing the sound for no good reason, but now he says he has several.
This effort is about imagination, and it's about seeing how far I can push these old bones. It's about the wonderful support I did receive from people. It's been really wonderful.
What's next for the two swimmers? They don't know, but they're thinking about starting a club. In Petersburg, I'm Shelby Herbert.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Wesley Early, Liz Ruskin, and Michael Finelli in Anchorage, Christina McDermott in Dillingham, and Shelby Herbert in Petersburg. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein online at lbblawyers.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.